I've been playing computer games for a long time. I started with my Commodore 128. Most of those games were like console games, like they could be played on an Atari or a Neo Geo, or in an arcade. But with my first 286, a Tandy, I played games like SimCity. I would spend hours on city design. And since I've gotten older, the games have taken more power to run and become more complicated. But they're still a wonderful way to decompress at the end of a hard day or week. Now, gamers are different. And so computer gaming is very broad. One night I was watching a game playthrough on YouTube, which is another fun way to experience a game that I don't have time to play or is too hard. I was explaining the game to my wife, and as I explained the complexity, she said, "That doesn't sound very fun." To which my stepdaughter, the other gamer in the family, said, "None of the games he likes are fun." And that may be true. I looked at the games and I kept coming back and even had to ask myself, why is this fun? There's No Man's Sky, which takes place in a computer-simulated galaxy where one travels from planet to planet with no real goal. It's purely about traveling. Then there's Factorio, where one is crash-landed on a hostile planet and then has to build a complicated factory to launch a rocket into space. There's Stardew Valley, where the protagonist leaves his corporate life to take over his grandfather's farm. Literally, it's just farming. Subnautica involves a ship, once again, that crash-landed on a water planet and has to build, and the protagonist has to build to save their own life while unwrapping a mystery before flying home. But I think the one my family can't understand the most is Kerbal Space Program, which came out in 2011. Throughout the game, we play the director of the space program. Then at launch, we are the pilot of the ship or the ground commander controlling the probe. Kerbal takes place in a fictional star system full of little green people who want to explore space. As you play the game, you're given access to better controllers, fuel tanks, engines, and science experiments. At the beginning of the game, all we can do is strap a command module on a solid fuel rocket with a Kerbal in it in a parachute. By mid-game, we're able to launch space stations and extraplanetary bases that land on other planets. NASA has embraced this game, and I'm going to tell you why. Your ship has to be aerodynamic enough to get out of the different stages of the atmosphere. It has to have enough fuel, not just to get into space, but to get where you're going. Remember, adding fuel adds more weight and affects the thrust-to-weight ratio on the rocket. The heavier the rocket, the more fuel it takes. The more fuel it takes, the more thrust, the more engines. Then, when you actually get into space, you have to perform a circularizing burn at your apoapsis with the ship facing towards the horizon line of your nav ball. It's mission critical that you do this at the right time. Too early and you waste fuel, too late and your periapsis doesn't make it out of carbon's atmosphere. Once circularized, if you're planning on going to the moon, you have to perform a Holman transfer. You get to the moon by burning hard at a 90 degree vector towards the moon when it's just coming out of the horizon. And it's not like you're taking a straight shot. In fact, what you're really doing in a Holman transfer is increasing the orbit until it encompasses the thing you're trying to get to. At this point, you get an interaction with the moon where the moon's gravity interacts with the ship and begins to pull you out of the gravity of the planet. At this point, when you get an interaction with the moon, you have to wait until you reach the closest pass and perform a retrograde burn, hoping you have enough fuel to provide the necessary delta V, the change in velocity, to not just circularize, but to land take off again, recircularize, perform another Holman transfer to Kerbin, then land your capsule without burning up in the atmosphere. The process in Kerbal Space Program is very similar to the complexity to the process of getting to the moon in real life. Because of its detail, NASA loves games like Kerbal Space Program. Games like Kerbal remind us that if we build the rocket wrong, if we don't do the math right, or mishandle the stick, there is a mission-critical failure that can kill astronauts. Looking back on the Apollo moon landing, it's easy to oversimplify the story, especially for someone like me who wasn't born yet. Someone who was born into a world with footprints in the moon looks differently upon the moon landing than someone who watched it on TV. In fact, if you are younger than 49 in 2019, you probably live in the same world I do, where there have always been footprints on the moon. The story was simple. JFK said we were going to go to the moon, so we did. A few years after his speech, the Saturn V rocket took off, got into space, beelined for the moon. The lander disconnected, landed. Neil spoke. They got into the lander, then came home. And Tom Hanks went a few years later. And the world came together as Apollo 13 almost didn't make it home. And then there's Challenger that happened some years later, but that's a whole nother story. But as I learned later and got older, I realized the story is a lot more complicated than that. As a child, we didn't spend much time talking about the Apollo 1, which is known as the plugs-out test. This is where the Apollo craft sits on top of the Saturn V and doesn't even take off. They pull the plugs and expect it to work on its own merit. And there are three astronauts who lost their lives when a fire broke out in the Apollo 1, just sitting on the launch pad. There was a pure oxygen environment, and the door was too complicated to open. Though the astronauts lost their lives, this taught at NASA a very important lesson. The door must be easier to open. I didn't know that Neil Armstrong almost lost his life performing the first docking in space with the Gemini 8 when the thrusters went out of control. I didn't know that Neil Armstrong almost lost his life again while practicing the moon landing on Earth when the practice lander malfunctioned. Had he not ejected at the right time, he'd have never said his famous words. In the movie First Man, during discussions of these failures, Neil Armstrong, when they asked whether it was worth it, said, "We have to fail down here so we don't fail up there." And with one statement, I am reminded that the history of NASA is a history of failure. In fact, there was so much failure, they almost lost support from Congress and the American people before ever taking off. These failures make people ask, even today, is space travel worth it? Katherine Johnson, the first African-American physicist to work with NASA, responded to this question in an interview when she was 92 years old. They asked Katherine, "Why go to the moon?" Her reply was very simple. "Why stay home?" But failures give way to success. For example, the Apollo 11 was made up of three ships. Knowing these things, the names is pivotal to understanding the next part of my sermon. During the launch, astronauts are in the capsule. The capsule, when connected to its thrusters, is called the command module. The last part, the lunar module, is often called the LEM. During launch, the command module separates from its boosters, called the Saturn V. Once in orbit, the command module turns around and docks with the LEM, pulling it out of its shroud. It then burns hard towards the horizon and circularizes. After two orbits, they perform a Holman transfer. Then once in orbit of the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin get into the LEM, disconnect, and start to burn retrograde towards the moon to kill off velocity before landing. This didn't go smoothly. As soon as the LEM disconnected, it began to have communication problems with Earth. But they kept going regardless. As they began to approach the moon, a bunch of alarms started going off. The landing computer got a little overwhelmed, then it shut down and restarted. Control thought this was fine and told them just to keep going and ignore the lights. It's just like the check engine light on the dash. So the astronauts are doing their best to ignore the alarms and the lights that keep lighting up with a navigation computer that keeps shutting off and restarting. And apparently this was more annoying than a real problem and more distracting. So when Neil looked down, he realized they'd overshot their landing zone by 3 miles. They were actually at this point heading for a 300-foot deep crater. Buzz Aldrin said that that is when Neil went into manual control. Neil Armstrong was known to be soft-spoken and patient. Buzz Aldrin, not so much. So when they took control, when he took control from the computer, Buzz knew something was very wrong. With 30 seconds of fuel remaining, they still had not found a place to land. Looking out the window, Neil finally found a place that was not in a crater or full of too many boulders, and he landed the ship with very little fuel left. Once landed, they had to decompress the module so they could get out of the door because they had a pure oxygen environment inside the module. After 3 hours of decompression, they still had to wrestle the door open, almost tearing through the craft and forcing it into vacuum. And in doing so, Neil bumped into the ignition switch and broke it off. When it was time to go 20 hours later, after they had bad sleep because the lunar module was not made for sleeping, Buzz shoved a pen into the broken switch and flipped it on. The fact of the matter is this: stuff kept going wrong, and they were in a territory with no extraction in a hostile environment. One astronaut during Apollo 12 would say that the moon was a beautiful desolation. Space is dangerous because it is space. A vacuum that we have not evolved to handle. We must take air, water, food, and anything else that we may need. And we are often unable to simulate the Earth experience like gravity, which causes long-term health defects. Astronaut Scott Kelly, who has spent more time than any other American in space, over 500 days, some of which in the ISS and some of which flying missions, has since had bone density issues, eye and vision issues, and the wall of the heart began to thin. But this is not a sermon about the moon landing. It's a sermon about faith. I remember sitting before the ministerial fellowship and committee, hoping they would give me a thumbs up in Boston. Near the end of the interview, my mind already exhausted, having felt like I reached too many wrong answers. I began to ask, they asked a simple question that I couldn't answer. They asked to explain the core of my UU theology. The one question I had practiced over and over again. Being emotionally exhausted, I did not really answer very well. But I'll get back to that in a minute. Theodore Parker, a Unitarian minister, said in a sermon in the mid-1850s, "We cannot understand the moral universe. The arc is long, and our eyes reach but a little way. We cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight, but we can divine it by conscience, and we surely know that it bends towards justice." Many civil rights and social justice-oriented leaders would hone in on that phrase and point out, use it as a direction to their work. The most famous attribution to that quote is Martin Luther King Jr., who simplifies the concept and then takes it a little further and begins to define the place that that arc bends toward. You use have begun to use this phrase to describe our goal in the center place of our eschatology. He called that the beloved community. Theologically, this discussion defines our eschatology. Eschatology, for those of you who may not know, is the study of a theological endgame. Where are we going? Many faiths focus on the immortality of the soul in a paradise on the other side of the apocalypse. But Theodore Parker's statement reminds us that you use don't. In her book, A House for Hope, Rebecca Parker and John Buren's explore this ideal. Rebecca Parker says this: such theologies imagine that the promise of a new heaven and a new earth, a new paradise garden with its river and tree of life, will arrive in the future on the other side of apocalypse. In the meantime, they bless war and offer no resistance to environmental abuse. We can take this further and consider the humanitarian crisis on the southern border, in the nationalistic cries, America First. We are in a culture of people unwilling to take responsibility for the kingdom of God, who are just waiting to have it handed without a willingness to lay the groundwork, and in doing so, hurting others. James Luther Adams, UU minister and professor at Meadville Lombard and Harvard University, builds this responsibility into his core theology, saying this: religious liberalism affirms the moral obligation to direct one's efforts towards the establishment of a just and loving community. Saying even more bluntly, a faith that is not the sister of justice is bound to bring us grief. So what did I say to the MFC? I rambled about the theological imperative to create, not just anything, but beauty. At the end of the day, our goal is simple. As you use, we are here to build the beloved community. But simple and easy are two different things. There are too many people making too much money off of the maintenance of a system that marginalizes and breaks people, building their futures on the backs of others, holding them in glorified slavery from which there is no freedom. Our modern capitalism relies so heavily on scarcity that scarcity is created through hoarding to maintain control. In reality, there is enough housing that no one should become homeless. There is enough food that no one should starve. And education could be given to anyone, but is sold at such a high price. It is inaccessible to many, except through the indentured servitude of a student loan. We are called to Unitarian Universalism, not to just debate the day or the local politics, or to gather passively like like-minded people. We are called to the act of divine creation in which we lay the blocks for the beloved community. If we are to take our eschatology seriously, we are responsible for the new heaven and the new earth. We are responsible for building the new Eden. And I have to say that we have that opportunity now. We have that opportunity locally. We have that opportunity as Unitarian Universalists worldwide. As Unitarian Universalists, we take responsibility for building the beloved community. And we will fail. And some UUs may even die for it. Just ask the family of James Reeb. But when we're confronted with failure, I think back to the words of JFK when he called us to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they're easy, but because they're hard. And I think I would add, we choose to do hard things, not because they are hard, but because they are necessary. This year, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing reminds me that follow through has a cost, but faith overrides failure. That we will not get it right the first time is obvious. But if we keep going, if we keep working the problem, we will get better and better with everything we do. We are confronted as liberal religious people in Mississippi with an important call to faith, because if we can do it here, we can do it anywhere. We are the front line. We are the chalice that illuminates the South. We are UUs, and we will not give up. We will keep flying when the flight computer reboots. We may need to find a pen to jam into the ignition switch, but as long as we don't give up, we are living our liberal values. That's the call I make to you today, that as we go through our lives, as we go through the process of building something new, remember that we will fail, but faith overrides failure every time. Thank you.